Hi everyone!
Welcome back once again to Slap the Chicken, the only podcast that I've ever written. Here we all are at the fourth episode, and what a journey it's been, eh? On today's programme, we are going under the sea and exploring some of the science that walks with slimy legs upon the slimy sea. In the interests of making this podcast authentically watery, I decided to immerse myself in the creative writing process by sinking my slimy legs into Highgate Park Lake. I'm currently writing this sentence underwater, somewhere near that hut where you hire the boats. Just got to watch out for these. They don't. Okay, I'll get on with the episode. It's fine. Disclaimer. I am fine and well. I didn't get my mile swim badge when I was 12 for nothing. The geese are also doing splendidly because this is a happy podcast. We will begin with a fairly light subject as we figure out the science of bioluminescence. Bioluminescence is the emission of light by a living organism. It is not exclusive to the oceans, but it is the most prevalent there, so it is allowed into this podcast. So there. The glow may come directly from the animal or from bioluminescent microorganisms that live within it. This phenomenon has been recorded in detail by some of the greatest scientists of our age, Robert Boyle, Charles Darwin, and Owl City, to name a few. Aristotle was the first to produce a comprehensive list of bioluminescent creatures in the 3rd century BC. What do a professor of theology at the University of Paris, a lecturer in Cologne, the discoverer of arsenic, an author, a commentator on the writings of Aristotle and the Muslim scholars Avicenna and Averroes, a philosopher, a monk, the bishop of Regensburg, a doctor of the church, and a person officially recognised by the Catholic Church as the patron saint of scientists and philosophers have in common? The answer is that they were all the same person. Albertus Magnus fits into our story because one of his many books was an elaboration on Aristotle's list of bioluminescent creatures. He expanded the list to include, among other things, giant glowing birds. These birds, also described by Pliny the Elder, no less, were said to live in the Hercynian Forest, a vast ancient woodland which covered most of the south of what is now Germany. Unfortunately, they do not exist, but if scientists got things right the first time, there'd be several people out of a job. Albertus always had his books about astronomy, music theory, philosophy, natural science, theology, and alchemy to fall back on. So, how does the organism produce light? Well, within the bioluminescent creature are two types of chemical called luciferin and luciferase. Luciferin is a chemical which produces light when it reacts in the presence of luciferase. Luciferase is a type of enzyme which catalyses the reaction, that is to say, it makes the reaction happen faster. An enzyme can be thought of simplistically as a particle with a gap in the side. The luciferin will fit in the gap, react, and leave the gap. The shape of the gap is specific to the substance reacting, so the luciferin molecule will only fit into the gap in the luciferase enzyme that corresponds to it. Imagine the enzyme as a very specifically shaped lock, and luciferin as the only key that which will fit into it. Different bioluminescent organisms have different types of luciferin and luciferase, which tend to be named after the organism that they're hiding in. This reaction is very efficient, meaning that the creature doesn't generate a lot of waste heat. The different colours which you may see in bioluminescent animals come from the different types of luciferase and luciferin which are specific to that creature. In the deep sea, the most common colour is blue or green, since that is the most evolutionarily advantageous. If you were alive, why would you want to glow like that? One reason is that it makes it a lot easier to find something to eat when you're living in the dark. It's a bit like if the fridge light was attached to you and the yogurts you're trying to eat were a bit more violent than they usually are. A soft glowing light provides the perfect enticement for an unsuspecting soon-to-be snack, as the anglerfish will attest. Another animal which takes advantage of creating its own light is the stoplight loose jaw, a perfectly hideous fish which is so named because it has a little light under each eye, one red, one green. It is suspected that these lights are used to help the fish see its way around the depths as it looks for something to shove in its mouth, which can open surprisingly wide for a fish which is only 30 centimetres long. However, it's not a one-sided battle. Bioluminescence can also be used to confuse anything that tries to eat you. A beautiful demonstration of this tactic comes from something that resembles a cross between a squid and an octopus but is not classified as either. Enter Vampyrotuthis infernalis, whose scientific name translates to the vampire squid from hell. Yes, it's vampire squid time. Covering your attacker in a blanket of dark ink like a normal squid does doesn't really cut it when everything's pitch black anyway, so the vampire squid has another trick up its sleeve if it had them. That trick is the absolute classic of bombarding your attacker with glowing mucus, chucking it at the offending predator for several minutes before legging it in the opposite direction, or tentacling it. If there's one thing missing from the Twilight Saga, I would say that was it. Talking of squid, let's move on to the next topic, in which we discuss a squid which is slightly more ubiquitous. However, what you see isn't always the truth, because these squid are quantum. So strap in as we release the beast. A superconducting quantum interference device is a piece of technology whose name by some miracle just so happened to spell out squid. They will be referred to as squids from here on in. They are used to detect extremely small changes in magnetic field strength. Now, why would you want to do that? Well, one reason is that your body is constantly producing tiny electrical signals. For instance, there is a signal associated with the neurons in your brain firing when you're learning, having coherent thoughts, I wish, or carrying out a task. It was James Clerk Maxwell who proved that electricity and magnetism were not only connected, but two sides of the same coin. One of the consequences of this is that all electrical signals will have an associated magnetic field around them. Due to the size of the electrical signals in the body, the magnetic fields associated with them are very weak indeed. This situation only gets worse as you travel away from the source of the field and through denser material like bone and tissue. The change in magnetic field compared to the strength of the Earth, therefore, requires a highly sensitive device to detect it. Luckily, a squid is just that. Their use in medical physics is handy because it means biological processes can be monitored without cutting you open, sticking a probe inside you, or blasting you with some form of radiation. Always useful. Squids are not just useful for checking whether a person is alive. They can also be used to check how the Earth is doing. The ionosphere is the last bit of the Earth's atmosphere before outer space officially begins. It is a region of charged particles due to the ultraviolet radiation from the sun ionising the particles, that is, causing them to become charged. Squids can be used to detect transient luminous events, which occur in the lower part of the ionosphere. Transient luminous events are essentially near-space lightning, which occurs above normal thunderstorms. Two of the most common types are called elves, which are induced by lightning, and sprites, which are streams of light which start at the bottom of the ionosphere and zoom downwards. With all these electrically charged particles moving about, there's bound to be changes in magnetic field strength that the squid can detect. One centre that is using their squid to detect this is the LSBB in France. I am not going to pronounce the French name. Their squid lives in what used to be a command centre for France's nuclear missile system, so it's shielded by 518 metres of rock, 2 metres of reinforced concrete, and 2 centimetres of steel to top it off. This means any other closer fluctuations in magnetic field get filtered out. This device in particular is said to have shielding qualified for ionosphere detection, or SQUID for short. The entire system is therefore referred to as the SQUID squared. The SQUID squared is not just a one-trick pony, or mollusk, if you will. The equipment also managed to detect fluctuations in magnetic field in the rock around it due to a P wave from an earthquake. P waves and S waves are the two seismic waves which move through the Earth when there is an earthquake. The P waves arrive first because they move much faster than the S waves, but they are not as destructive. A seismic detector attached to the laboratory allowed it to be seen that these fluctuations in magnetic field within the rock were due to seismic activity because the two signals were happening at the same time as each other. But the rock is not the only thing that shakes during an earthquake. The P wave also causes the atmosphere to shake, in particular a section of the atmosphere called the mesopause. The mesopause is the area between the third and the fourth highest layers of the Earth's atmosphere, which lie below the ionosphere. The earthquake in question, which was described in a paper written in 2011, was over 5,000 miles away in Sichuan, China, on the 12th of May 2008. The warning signs of a quake began to be detected an hour before it struck. A few days later, the researchers found amateur videos being shared online of the sky around 500 kilometres away from the epicentre. They were of strange rainbow-coloured structures in the sky, which were due to the mesopause being forced to vibrate by the P wave. These structures in the atmosphere appeared at the same time as the biggest fluctuations in the magnetic field around the rock detected by the SQUID, further confirming that these fluctuations were associated with the earthquake. There is a slight snag when it comes to using SQUID technology. Some key components of the SQUID are pairs of metal rings in a superconducting state. A conductor of electricity is a material that allows current to pass through it easily. This current will have an associated resistance, and no matter how good the material is at conducting electricity, this resistance is always present at normal temperatures, that is. Cool your rings to about 4 degrees above absolute zero, and something exciting happens. Disclaimer. Physicists are excited by everything. This is why they find engineers so funny. At these low temperatures, the material transitions into a superconducting state. A superconductor is a material in such a state that a current may pass through it with no resistance whatsoever. This is ridiculous. As you might expect, keeping these rings at that temperature is no mean feat, requiring a lot of money, energy, and liquid helium. Helium is quite expensive and it's only getting scarcer, so this is a bit of a problem. Julio Iglesias. What shall we do to top this thing off then? Same way we finished last episode. That'll do. You see, life began in the ocean, so let's go back in time to where it all started and before everything went so badly wrong. Tetrapods are any animal with four limbs. Absolutely anything at all, from mammals to reptiles and birds. Fish are rather notable for their absence of four strong limbs, so what happened during the evolutionary journey in between? Fish started appearing during the Cambrian period, about 580 million years ago. The very first fish didn't have a separate jawbone, meaning that their bony little mouths were permanently stuck open. This was a terrible idea, especially when some other fish started developing separate jawbones which could open wide enough to fit another fish inside, a rather ratty temper, and a special appetite for fish who don't have jawbones. If you're wondering how you eat when you can't open and close your mouth, what these fish did was just sort of strafe along the bottom with their mouth open, hoping that something sort of falls inside. It was never going to work. It was during the Devonian period, about 370 million years ago, that some fish started getting an even better idea. Hey, we've got yours. How about legs? And so began the journey to four-legged bliss. Let's meet the lobe-finned fish and tetrapods that started everything off. Is there not a run? Got it going on. Their name is Strong Fins, and indeed their fins were strong. They walked around the seabed with grand ideas in their head. It was for land they longed, and that is where they would have gone if they were better adapted for land, that is, because their legs were not good enough. They were carnivores and could breathe through lungs as well as the usual set of gills that you might find in your common or garden fish. Their spine was closer to that of a modern tetrapod than it was to a fish, but it still was a bit rough and ready. Their hip bones were similarly primitive and not even attached to the spine. Poor show. Tiktaalik is a Nunavut word meaning large freshwater fish. The first person to send the answer in on a postcard as to what kind of animal Tiktaalik was wins nothing whatsoever. It gained its name because the first specimens were found on Ellesmere Island, which is in the Canadian Arctic Circle near where the Nunavut people live. By large, we mean 9 feet in length. Tiktaalik is stunning and iconic because about 375 million years ago, it used its sturdy fins to wriggle from the waters onto land. One of the ways in which Tiktaalik was better evolved for a life on the land was its alluringly wide hips. These provided more support to the back legs than the non-alluring, pathetic little hips of the fish that had gone before it, which meant that all of the stress was put on the front fins instead of all four lovely long fins like what Tiktaalik had. Disclaimer, the rumours about me and the Tiktaalik are not true. We are now in the realm of the first tetrapods. Ichthyostega were a genus of tetrapod which went the whole hog, with 7 fingers on each hand and 69 holes where the teeth were before time and the fossilisation process did away with them. There are 3 different species and they all look radical. The stress was still more on the front legs, but they did have lungs, so that crime is forgivable. But hold on a minute, how did we jump from a fish to a tetrapod? Elpistostega was the missing link because it had the beginnings of hands within its fins. Obviously, they weren't anything like the hands you or I are used to, but looking at the fossilised skeleton, the beginnings of a modern 5-fingered bone structure was there. You might even say that they were fish fingers. Unfortunately, that wouldn't be possible. These hands meant that it could no longer be classified as a fish because fish do not have hands. Disclaimer. If you are a fish with hands, please call in. If you or a loved one have had a run-in with a fish with hands, you may be subject to compensation. How lovely. Well, that wraps up this month's episode with a little under 2 weeks to go until some things could be legal again. This one goes out to all of my friends who I haven't seen in several months. I hope you're all doing well and that this March we will start to reverse the curse. Spring is coming and along with it a variety of beautiful insects to plague your very legal picnic. We will have a chat about them in the next episode. And we'll see you there. Disclaimer. Egyptian geese aren't geese, but ducks which are feral, but they'll still put you in similar peril.